Good morning and welcome to Taking Care of Business. I'm Jackie Mitchell. Good to have your company today. We get smarter today. That's always got to be a good thing. And we get smarter without changing your IQ, even better. Social intelligence expert Luke Ross joins me today. And we also speak to an up-and-coming author, Heidi Catherine, who is doing what a lot of people talk about. And we find out how to write a book and get it published. Today's inspiring show is brought to you by our friends at eView Real Estate. Now, my special co-host today, Luke Ross, is Australia's leading organisational and social psychologist and Taking Care of Business resident business shrink. I knew you'd like that. Hi, Luke. Welcome back.
Thanks, Jackie.
Always good to have you here. I always sort of feel mentally a bit more secure when you're here, or I could feel the other way, couldn't I?
Anyway, yeah, you could.
Now, how can we get smarter in business without changing our IQ?
Well, the fascinating thing, what we have known for quite some time, is pure raw IQ, your intelligence or your mental horsepower, is not that much of a predictor of performance in the workplace.
Really?
Yeah, it's interestingly, it does predict it to some degree, but it's not as strong as what we think. What actually is a stronger predictor of performance in the workplace are things like emotional intelligence, resilience, tenacity, conscientiousness, and those sorts of things. That's what differentiates between top, middle, and sort of bottom performers in the workplace.
Really? Mm. So EQ is the emotional intelligence.
Yep.
It takes precedence over IQ in the workplace. Is that
Well, you need it depends on the job a bit. And so different jobs have different requirements for intellectual processing power. But EQ really is a strong differentiator in leadership. Absolutely, in leadership roles and things like that. And EQ's gone through a really interesting evolution. When we first started looking at EQ, it was really around, how well does someone perceive their own emotions and their impact of emotions on others. We've now moved a fair way along the path looking at behavioural EQ, which is what do you actually do with that insight.
So what are some tips to help improve your EQ in the workplace?
Your behavioural EQ? Well, interestingly, when we first started doing this sort of work, the training and the workshops was all around really focusing on yourself and your ability to perceive your own emotions. That can be a bit of a rabbit warren and can actually be really, really hard. What's actually far easier to develop your EQ is actually just look at your behaviour, what you actually do with other people. Because what we know with the new brain science and things like that, your behavior affects what actually occurs in your brain. It affects your chemicals and all that sort of stuff. So your behavior can actually change your attitudes and can potentially change your brain function, which can develop your EQ.
Okay, so it's sort of looking at from the inside out?
Well, it's going backwards.
Yeah,
it's actually going backwards to what you think. So, for example, focusing on your levels of conscientiousness, how much attention you pay to things and things like that, can have a huge impact on how you're perceived by others, which therefore has a huge impact on your performance in the workplace.
But aren't a lot of people unaware of their behaviour? So do you need quite a high self-awareness to actually be thinking about your behaviour?
You know, that is an absolutely fantastic observation, because that is so true. What we know is we don't spend a lot of time looking at our own behaviour. Mm. We spend a lot of time judging
others'
behaviour.
Yes, exactly.
Which is far more fun, right?
That's
That's what lunch is made up about. That's what, nasty emails are made up about.
I've done nothing wrong.
Exactly right. I mean, if anyone watched The Bachelorette last night, we saw one of those characters leave.
Do you watch that?
I absolutely, as a social psych, right? I'm obsessed with any of this sort of stuff, right? that's like fodder. That is just
Luke.
A gift to a social psych, those shows. But we spend a lot of time judging and blaming other people, whereas what we can do to be far more effective is really look at what do we do and what does the impact it have.
Yeah. How do we increase our self-awareness then?
Well, number one is actually making a decision to actually look at what you do. And number two is actually ask other people, because we are notoriously bad at actually judging and observing our own behaviour.
So if you're working with someone who clearly has no self-awareness and their behaviour is pretty poor, is it advisable to say to them, you need to increase your self-awareness. I can yes, exactly. I can imagine that sort of wouldn't go down so well. So how do you, is there a way you can tell them that, that's going to have a more likely positive outcome?
Well, interestingly, the theory I live by, which works pretty well, is you won't get what you want until they get what they think they must have. So rather than focusing on them, work out what do they actually need, earn their support, earn their respect.
The with them.
Yeah, exactly right. Because it's a law of sort of what we call psychological reciprocity, which is give stuff to other people before you ask something from them. And if you're giving someone feedback, you're actually asking something from them. What you're asking is you're asking them to change.
Mm.
And people don't like change. No. We are comfort seekers.
Yeah.
And the reason people don't like change is most people view change as loss. They think they're going to lose something and they're going to lose power, status, relationships, wealth, income, whatever. And so that's why people resist change so much. So, bit of a long answer, I know.
No, it's a good answer.
Yeah, thank you.
Keep going.
But yeah, so really work out what do they need, give them what they need first before you start asking them to change.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, I mean, the classic situation is you have a number of people in the workplace who really, really like some form of recognition. That's their number one thing. So work out what is it that they do really, really well.
Okay, so give them a compliment of
yeah,
some
but
sort.
It's not a fake compliment because people, what we know is authenticity is a key performance indicator as well.
Right.
So it's not about being insincere.
Yeah.
It's actually looking, because everyone has a gift and something they do really, really well,
but
often don't get recognized for it. So if you give them that recognition, that sort of settles them down and you see people calm down. When they get what they think they must have, they calm down and then they've got their ears on. Until they've got that sort of calm space and they've got their ears on, there's no point in giving feedback.
Oh, that is such a good tip. I love that.
Thanks.
Now, you've just come back from...
Over in LA, yes.
LA.
Yep.
And I believe that you were on a very famous stage.
I was on a very famous stage. I was working with 700 top performers in a large global brand. And what we were helping them work on is their resilience. So their ability to thrive and change. Because what we know is change in the workplace is not going away. It's increasing and it's coming more rapidly. So there's more of it coming more rapidly. So what we know is those people who love change, who thrive in change, they're the ones who are successful in the workplace. Those people who ignore change, hate change, deny change or fight change, they're the ones who are going to get left by the wayside. So that's what we were helping this group do, is really working on their mindsets to change. Because if you change someone's, sounds a bit bizarre, if you change someone's change mindset to loving change, all of a sudden their performance just goes up and their happiness goes up, their stress levels go down, their life satisfaction goes up, and interestingly, even their physical and psychological fitness and health goes up.
But certainly it's baby steps to change. You wouldn't go from someone not liking change to loving it. That's a huge leap. Is that or not?
It's actually not.
Oh.
It's really, really interesting. And so what happens, you know, with change is often change is imposed on people and forced on people. And so therefore they resist and fight it.
Mm.
But if you can help someone understand that change is not going away, so accept change is more, and then show them how to love it, It's almost addictive, and I do this myself, right? I have lots of change in my life. I mean, you know, from a personal perspective, this is kind of deep, but go with it.
Yeah.
Recently, I've lost vision in one eye, and I've had 7 operations on that eye. That's quite a change.
Mm.
Now, I could fight that, I could ignore it, I could deny it, I could hate it, but all that would do is make me stagnate and focus on the change as opposed to the benefits of the change. That's a weird thing. I'm talking about being grateful that I've lost vision in one eye. That propels you forward, but being angry about losing vision in one eye, that makes you stagnate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But isn't that part of the sort of grieving process that you've actually got, you know, you go that 4 stages of grief. Does that apply or not? Like, were you angry to begin with, and then as you moved along the process, you then got to acceptance, and that's when then you can impose the change or accept the change?
Well, interestingly, no, I wasn't that angry.
Oh.
You know, stuff happens.
Yeah, okay.
And where a lot of that came from is actually from my upbringing, because interestingly, our resilience, more than 40% of our resilience and our change mindset is actually taught to us by our parents, major socializing agencies like school, university, whatever it is. And so I was really taught, you know, whatever is dealt to you, you accept it, you move on, and you make the best of it. Because there's just no point wallowing in what you've lost, because you can't get it back. All that happens is you just lose time, and you actually lose enthusiasm, you lose energy, and you actually lose life satisfaction. Same thing happens when people, say, compare themselves to their friends on Facebook. You know, Facebook is a highlight reel. So if you're comparing your life to someone else's Facebook life, you're going to come off second best, and you're going to focus on what you don't have. Whereas flip it around, focusing on what you do have, it's so much more fun.
Yeah, it's that gratitude, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's a conscious decision, because we don't naturally do it.
Yeah, it's about that back to awareness, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and there's a biological basis to it. We've got a negativity bias as part of our brain, which is part of our survival mechanism, that actually makes us focus on what we don't have.
Right. When I've spoken to lots of very successful people and entrepreneurs, and I always like to look for common threads of keys to success for obvious reasons, to try and, you know, copy it at least. One thing that comes out consistently is for someone to be successful, the key element, resilience, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned about your upbringing, and that's a bonus, I suppose. Now, what if you haven't had that in your upbringing?
Yep.
How can you improve your resilience?
Well, that's another fantastic question. That's what we were doing over in LA. There's a lot of people I had a very, very sort of positive upbringing. Not everyone, like you said, has that upbringing. Mm. And we know we learn a lot of this from our parents, and they learn it from their parents, and they learn it from their parents. The first thing is that change mindset, and it's moving from change equals loss to change equals gain. So that's just a simple decision. So when something comes at you, some adverse situation comes at you, it's a simple mindset of how can I grab this situation and thrive, as opposed to how can I try and just manage this situation? That's just a mindset. And then what we have is we have some really good learnings from cognitive behavioral therapy, because what we know is a challenge comes at you, or an adverse event comes at you, and then what happens is we respond with behaviors and emotions. What happens a nanosecond before those behaviors and emotions is a whole range of things known as automatic thoughts. A lot of the time we have negative automatic thoughts, which say, let's say you get really bad feedback from your boss, and then you'll react, you know, in a negative way, an angry way or something like that. What often we don't realize is there was a little automatic thought which says that may have been, well, I'm no good at my job. But it's at a really, really low level of consciousness. We don't actually know it's there. But if you slow your brain down a bit and replace those automatic thoughts with active thinking, which is, in that situation, you know what, maybe my boss actually really cares about my performance and wants to give me feedback, that will transform your ability to thrive and challenge.
Now, just hold that automatic thought.
Yes.
Because I need a coffee after all that. While I digest it, and I'm sure our listeners, if you haven't got your coffee already, get it, because our next guest that's coming up after this break is going to tell us how you can change career to become an author. You hear people talk about that all the time. And how you can actually then get a published work. Listen smarter, not harder. You're listening to Taking Care of Business on Ardor PFM. Be right back after this. Welcome back. It is 20 past 11, and someone who almost every day writes a book, that of course was the fabulous Elvis Costello, is an emerging author, Heidi Catherine, who just won the Academy Award in Australia for writing. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Jackie.
Now tell us this award you won. It's an Australian award, and it was the Academy Award of Writing.
Oh, that's how it's sort of, it has been known, or we do sort of affectionately call it that. But the award was, I've recently written a young adult fantasy trilogy called The Soul Weaver, and I entered the first book in Romance Writers of Australia's Emerald Pro Awards, and they're for the best unpublished manuscript written by a published author, and I was lucky enough to win first place.
Okay, so you haven't been published yet, so it was an unpublished?
It's an unpublished manuscript, right. And although I have a self-published ebook, which is why I had to enter the published author category of the awards.
Now, the published thing, can we just go through that? I get a bit confused about it. Every time an author goes, you're published, you're unpublished. What's the big deal about being published or unpublished?
It's becoming a bit of a grey area, I guess, in terms of how you would define being published or not published, because of self-publishing now is such a huge, huge thing. So if you have a self-published book, You're published. Why not?
Yeah.
So it's all in the way you look at it and what your definition is.
Okay. So Soul Weaver that you won the award for,
yes.
Is it going to be published?
Oh, I would hope so. So that's the idea and that's the plan. And by winning the award, this hopefully will hold me in good stead with when I'm approaching publishers and agents. So I've got a much better chance of it being looked at a little bit more seriously
now.
Well,
you got on the show because you won the award.
Absolutely.
I saw you won the award and I thought to myself, well, that'd be really good to get you in. Now, I must also say Heidi and I used to work together a long time ago and I know she's got a business degree in marketing. We worked in marketing together. Now, you've had a career transition. I just want to touch on that for a minute because I find that quite fascinating and I think a lot of people listening, most people all have an idea, I'd like to write a book one day or I've got ideas for a book or I've started writing, I'm not quite sure if I want to do it or not. So why the transition from marketing? You then went into proofreading and copywriting. So you obviously were attracted to the writing area. Is that something always been of interest to you?
Oh, absolutely. I've always loved reading and I've always loved to write. And so it's a bit of a dream to be doing it full time at the moment. So I did start off in marketing and loved doing that. And then when I had my children, I wanted to work from home. So I started doing my own proofreading and corporate copywriting as a freelancer.
Yeah.
And it's only been the last couple of years that I've decided to focus on my writing projects as my priority.
So do you describe yourself now as an author when people say, what do you do? Hi, Heidi, what do you do?
I'm a writer.
You're a writer?
Yeah.
Okay, so rather than an author, you say writer.
I do. I guess perhaps that's more out of habit in one way because I was a corporate copywriter for a long time and often if you say to people, I'm a corporate copywriter, they might look at you like, what on earth are you talking about? So it's just been a habit, I guess, to describe myself as a writer and it still applies. So
now, with the writing, it's always funny because you hear stories about, you know, all the great writers and they'd go to these remote islands, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson will go to Samoa and write a book there or, you know, at different places. And then there's also different routines where some writers will have a schedule and they'll work, you know, whether it be 9 to 5 or they might work in 2-hour blocks. There's such a variety of different processes. What's yours?
Oh, I'd love to lie on a beach somewhere exotic and write a book. But unfortunately, it's not quite as glamorous as that because I do have other responsibilities in my life, such as I have two young children that need me still. So I tend to drop my boys off at school, come home and write for as long as I can with a nice quiet house and until it's time to pick the boys up again.
So you can be self-disciplined enough to make that work for you.
Absolutely. And it's, look, some days it's easier to do that than others. So there's a lot of saying no to coffee dates and a lot of those kinds of occasions, but you can't say no all the time. You've got to have a life as well.
Yeah,
otherwise
yeah.
Your writing's going to get quite boring as well.
It's interesting about understanding, and Luke Ross might have a comment on this, I'm sure he has, about understanding yourself and what works best, like which is the best time of day that you get your best work done. Now I know myself with you in a day when I'm operating at my optimum. So if I've got to write something like a strategy or I've got to think, you know, a bit more heavily than normal, 10 a.m. till 12 noon is a really peak time and 5 till 7. I don't know why. I just know they're my best times. So is that something that you have to be aware of, Luke, or is that How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. And most people, as they go through life, they sort of work that out. But if you pay conscious attention to it, you'll see when you're most creative, you're most disciplined and you're most focused. But what was really, really, really interesting is as I was watching you talk, Heidi, when you said, I'm a writer, your face lit up and you sat up straighter in your chair. And that's probably the most important thing from a discipline perspective. It's the labels that we give ourselves. And you're a writer and that's what a writer does and that's what probably actually gives you the discipline to say no to those coffee dates. Whereas if you sort of dabble with something and you don't really give yourself the label and don't own it, you don't fully commit to it.
Oh, so he's a bit scary in one way having him in the studio. Because,
I know, he's good, isn't he?
He's fantastic. Now, do you ever get writer's block?
Oh, I think every writer gets writer's block occasionally, but
or work block. I get that a lot too. Yeah,
I tend to deal with it more often though by instead of sitting there and trying to force an idea, I'll stand up from my computer and I'll walk away from it. I'll take the dog for a walk, or I'll vacuum the house, or say yes to a coffee date. And usually, I'll find that my subconscious will turn on the problem, and I'll come up with a solution that way.
How did you learn to do that?
Oh, trial and error, I guess.
Really? Yeah. And how do you, what inspires you? Where do you get your ideas from?
I describe myself on Twitter as a magpie, because I collect shiny ideas and I store them in my nest to write about later. So I just walk around with my eyes and my ears open. There are ideas everywhere. So when I sat down to write The Soul Weaver, the idea for that actually came from a conversation I had with my mum when I was 8 years old. And that was something that I'd tucked away somewhere in my brain and came 30 years later and pulled that idea out and did something with it. So there really are ideas everywhere.
Okay. Now, Heidi Catherine is your pen name.
Yes.
Why did you decide to use a pen name?
I think that was my marketing background coming into play there, because I was aware that as an author, my brand is my name. And I do have an 11-letter Greek surname, with thanks to my husband. And I do have a maiden name that starts with a ZW. So I just felt like there wasn't a lot of point in having a brand name that nobody could pronounce or spell. So I went with Catherine, which is my middle name.
Yeah, yeah.
And it still feels like me because it is my name.
Yeah, I think it's really clever, because it's about the brand and separating yourself from you. And it's difficult. I know I do some personal branding stuff, and when you've got your own name as a brand, as you do, Luke Ross, and I do as Jackie Mitchell, and separating that from yourself, who you really are, to looking at it as a brand is very challenging. And so actually having that pen name is a great idea. Have you found that's worked?
Oh, absolutely. It also gives me a little bit of privacy, I feel, because I have my website and I have a presence on Twitter and Facebook and so forth. It's nice to have that little bit of privacy as well with what your real name is versus your pen name or brand name.
Which authors inspire you?
Oh, goodness. I mean, I don't think any young adult author could not be inspired by J.K. Rowling or Stephanie Meyer from Twilight or Suzanne Collins from The Hunger Games. But I have a lot of local authors who have become heroes of mine as well, who I've quite a few have met through doing courses or seminars and so forth. So there are authors like Marion Lennox or Natasha Lester, Kylie Ladd or Jennifer St. George who I've met and who have helped me along the way and I've kept in touch with. So they're definitely inspirational as well.
What do you learn from them?
There's a lot of things to be learnt from people who are doing what you would like to do, or are they in a place that you'd like to be in. So not only is it all about writing skills, but I think it's also how to present yourself as a writer. So how to promote yourself online and by doing courses. So you're promoting yourself. So it's a whole package deal. It's not just the writing skills. It's also how they also are able to take up and coming writers under their wing and be a mentor to them. So hopefully I'm in a position to do that for other writers one day myself.
It's an interesting time because we're writing now more than ever with emails, for instance, where once upon a time we used to pick up the phone, and so verbal communication was always preferable. Where now we're writing emails, people are writing blogs, there are websites which people are getting into. You know, used to actually have a hard copy brochure and go, here you go, here's my business. Now there's websites and there's a lot more writing.
Yep.
Have you found that challenging, Heidi, with everyone, you know, thinking they're a writer of some description?
It's been a little bit challenging, but I think you just have to break it down and look at what's going to work for you and tackle one of them at a time. So it's certainly something you have to do. You can't just write a good book and have it sitting there on your computer and expect that somebody's going to notice you and see it and publish you. You have to put yourself out there. So it's part and parcel of what you do these days.
And is that like entering awards?
Absolutely. Entering awards, doing courses, joining organisations, they're all important.
Now, the quick question. How do you make money?
Well, not a quick question at all.
No, okay, it's a long one. So we might come back to that. We might have a quick break. We can digest it. We can ponder it. And we'll just have a quick break.
Okay.
Have a sip of that coffee. Have a think about that.
Okay.
And we'll be right back after this. We all want to get smart. And today we are talking about how to get smarter without changing your IQ with Luke Ross and rising star author Heidi Catherine. Now, just before the break, we left off with Heidi pondering the question I asked about making money, and it's not an arts program because they never talk about making money, but we are a business show, so we have to ask It's a lovely dream and author and you're successful and things, but how do you then convert that mm-hmm. into a business?
Look, the primary way you're going to make money as an author is obviously by selling books.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you're self-published or whether you're published through more traditional means, that will be your primary source of income. However, there are other ways you can run courses as an author.
Oh, okay.
Or
yep.
You might there are lots of little, you might have speaking engagements that are
yep.
paid. So
yep.
But primarily the sales of your books will be your bread and butter. So it's quite hard at the moment with my books not having been traditionally published or even self-published with my young adult trilogy. I'm not making any money from them at the moment, but I'm planning ahead for the future. So certainly my intent one day would be for those books to be published and for some income to be coming in.
Okay, so part of your plan, you knew you weren't going to make
That's
money
right.
initially. And so did you plan that?
Absolutely. It was something that I knew I was going to need to put a lot of work in, and I knew that wasn't going to be a case of a few days or a few weeks or months. I knew it would be years of earning no income, but I felt that if I didn't focus on it full time, that I would never actually achieve my dream of being published. So I'm lucky enough to have a supportive husband who's able to back me up on that. And without that support, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing now.
But I think the key message there that I'm taking out is that, you know, people think, oh, I want to become an author,
mm-hmm.
and then they're going to start making money in a month or 2 months.
No,
you need
it's,
to actually
it's
go,
years.
You know, yeah, okay.
Unless...
So you need to actually, you know, have that financial support behind you to go, okay, you know what, I'm going to invest in this, I'm mm-hmm. going to dedicate it, I want a career change, but the downside is I'm not going to earn an income for 12 months or 2 years.
Absolutely, although I'm probably one of the more unusual ones. I am quite fortunate to be able to do this at the moment in the way that I am. What most people would do is they don't give up their day job.
Yes.
They do this at night and weekends yeah. and whenever they can squeeze it in, and then once they're managed to either self-publish or have a publishing deal go through, then they're able to maybe hopefully one day leave their day job and focus on their writing full time.
Yeah, it's interesting about the writing, because it used to be that you would do an introduction, then you'd do the body of the work and then the conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happening now is with people's attention spans, Luke, they're getting shorter and shorter, aren't they? Because we're being bombarded with so many messages.
Yeah, absolutely. I read a stat the other day, and this might not be exactly it, but it's around about this, that in the last 11 years, the average adult attention span, I think, was at 13 minutes. It's now below 5 minutes.
See, that's important for businesses, particularly from a marketing and communication perspective.
Absolutely. Those messages, they've got to be so short.
Mm.
And the evidence of this is if anyone looks at how they read emails, you know, we skim read emails.
Yeah.
The title is what determines whether we're going to read the contents. And also if we look at the amount of information that is now consumed on smartphones, even from a design of how much information, if it can be in one smartphone screen without a swipe, you're going to get far greater cut through than if someone's got a swipe.
Yeah, and that's why Twitter has been successful.
Yes.
It allowed you 140 characters. You had to think about it,
yep.
but it actually Absolutely. Was filling a gap, our mental gap, I suppose,
yeah.
of what we need to do. Is that filtering, that skimming, is that a coping mechanism? Are we being bombarded?
This is just a personal opinion. Absolutely, it's a coping mechanism. What we see a lot in corporate businesses is the CYA behavior, cover your exactly right behavior.
Yeah.
And so people skim read emails just to make sure that I'm across it in case I need to be across it, but they're actually not across it. Interestingly, there's been some research that's come out about multitasking and attention facilities. And if you're concentrating on three or more things, it's the equivalent to actually being smoking marijuana. That's how much it reduces your attention facilities. And when we think about what we actually do, one of those things is focusing on the internal dialogue in your head. We know on average, an average adult spends about 50% of their time mind wandering when they're talking to someone else. That's one thing. And if you think about, like, so someone sitting there watching television, that's one thing. Mind wandering, that's two things. Maybe talking to a child, that's three things. That's why so much stuff gets missed.
Yeah, so really, as human beings, regardless of gender,
yep.
cannot multitask effectively.
No. And interestingly, there's research coming out that's showing that multitasking is related to life dissatisfaction as well. And I've got a view on this. My wife, she's a psychologist like I am, and she's a seriously sort of effective person. But I watched her when she was a young professional and then becoming a working mum. And this multitasking thing, absolutely, it just, you get that feeling that you can't achieve anything. And Heidi, you probably could have a comment on this. As a working mum, your attention is so split, you never really feel like you can fully commit or achieve something in its entirety. And that's also why we see this great trend in mindfulness, because our minds are so diffused in terms of attention that what's coming through is just spending time just focusing on one simple thing like your breathing or trying to touch your nose as closely as you can has a huge impact on your levels of stress, management, health, happiness and all those sorts of things.
Oh, no, absolutely. You kind of alarmed me a bit when you said that if you're doing more than three things at once, it's like smoking marijuana. I thought I must be walking around permanently stoned. So I think every mother could kind of, you're always doing at least 17 things at once. And it seems to be the way that we're all going these days. Everybody's busy.
Yeah.
Busyness almost seems to be a badge of honour at times as well.
But it doesn't breed happiness, though.
No, it doesn't at all.
No, because you don't, you know, it can be simple things like you don't fully, you know, concentrate on a conversation with your kid. I mean, I do it myself, right? My darling daughter, I know how many times she said something to me and it's only about 3 hours later I've heard what she said, like, you know, you're the best dad in the world. And I've just gone, because I've been doing three other things.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think maybe that could be a good title for a book, Heidi. I don't know if you get that mind wandering. I like that.
I do. It's Did great, you? Isn't it? I good. Loved it too. Yeah, absolutely.
I like mind wandering. I like that. Now, the other, I always like words being a brand nut. The other one I liked was the concept of flash fiction. I don't know if it's the fiction or the flash bit I like, but I like the two together, flash fiction. Absolutely. Now, what is that?
It's when people are writing very short stories, generally to a particular word length. So I love to submit stories to, there's a website called 81 Words, and every story you submit must be 81 words or you cannot submit it. So not 80 words, not 82, 81 words.
It's exactly 81.
And it's great fun. I mean, to read the other stories, you don't need to have much attention span to do that. They're over before you've started them, really. 81 words is not much.
How long would it take you to read 81 words? Do you reckon?
It's really a couple of paragraphs. It's not long at all.
Okay, so a minute
or one big
minutes.
Paragraph. Yeah.
So that actually, again, is fulfilling this snacking behaviour or the short attention span that we're, or I like to term sushi learning, these sort of short bites, sort of bite-sized bits of learning.
Absolutely. And so it's lots of fun too.
Yeah. Ah.
So a good way to procrastinate too, if you're avoiding writing your novel that day, write an 81-word story, get yourself going, and then I find that I'm off and away.
So it's getting started, I've always heard, is the hardest thing. Mm. Someone said to me once about writing is about rewriting.
Oh, absolutely.
Is that your experience?
Absolutely. You write and you write and you write, and when you're finished, all you're doing is rewriting. It's a constant process.
Yeah, because I used to always find it hard to get started because I'd put so much pressure on myself, I've got to get it right first time. And that writing changed everything. Just get it down and then continue to edit it as you go along.
I'm not even certain you get it right the 100th time. At some point, you've got to just choose to let it go and say, right, this is as good as I'm going to be able to get it.
Yeah.
So,
do you get other people's opinions? Did you write and say, give the manuscript or document to other people and say, can you give me your view? And
oh, absolutely. It's really important to do that.
Where do you draw the line? How many people do you ask and who do you ask?
Oh, you start with your mother because she's going to say it's wonderful.
Yeah. So
that's always that gives you the confidence to then go on.
Yeah.
But I'm lucky I have a number of critique partners who I've met over the years, and we exchange work between ourselves and we read each other's work and give comments.
That's a good tip. Where do you find these critique partners?
Well, if you join organisations, so for example, if you join Romance Writers of Australia or Writers Victoria or organisations like that, they can put you in touch with different critique groups and writing groups, and it's an excellent way to get somebody. I mean, as much as it is lovely to have someone who knows you and loves you tell you it's a wonderful piece of work, you really need somebody who's going to actually go through it, someone who knows about writing as well, someone who's going to give you the truth, which isn't always easy.
No, it's not, is it?
It's important, though.
It is important, and it's important to separate that emotion
Absolutely.
From you, yeah.
And you need a very thick skin, lots of patience and a very thick skin. Oh, absolutely. So you need to be able to take feedback on board, see it for what it is, and use it to your advantage.
Okay. Now, the other trend with this, you know, snack bite, snack size learning and attention span issue is that we've more attracted to visual.
Yep.
You know, so pictures are really important. So short amount of words and lots of visual, because it's easier for our brains to process a picture than it is to process words. Is that your experience?
Yeah, and the web sort of stats really show that the amount of video that is now channeling through the internet is through the roof. If we and it's at all levels. If we look at the C-suite, so the chief executive officer, chief marketing officer, and those sort of senior people, what we know is. Forbes do a research, and I think it's 63% of the C-suite are viewing a product-related video per week. So once upon a time, they used to read text and those sorts of things, but even the most senior people are consuming through video. So video is absolutely the future.
So with writing, Heidi, a lot of books have, you know, the front cover and some have pictures in it. Is that something that you've considered?
Oh, look, but it's also more than that. When you think about it, a lot of the best-selling books are also movies. So you're getting the visual element that way. So some people might see the movie and then say, hey, I really wanted to read the book for that. I like to do it the other way around. I like to read the book first. But so that's where I think the visual element is coming in. And of course, covers are hugely important on a book as well.
There's your marketing coming out again. Really important. Mm. I've always said to people, walk into a wine shop and have a look at a wall of wine and have a look where your eyes, you know, be conscious of where your eyes are attracted to it, and it will be attracted to labels.
Absolutely.
And if you look at a lot of wine labels, they all sort of look the same.
They
and
do.
You can actually pick out the ones, that, the design of it, and I'm sure with books as well. But are people still going into bookshops and buying books?
They absolutely are. Or they're buying books online. So as much as e-books have taken off, people still love. The paper book is not dead yet.
Isn't it?
No, long way off.
Audio books, they're becoming more popular, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they've become more popular. I think they've always had a particular place in the market. People are spending more time in their cars and things like that as well, and an e-book audio books are a great place to do that. So I know Stephen King always talks about how he listens to a lot of books in his car and he listens to a lot of audio books. So that was quite interesting to hear. I wouldn't have expected an author like him to be into audiobooks, but there you go.
Oh, it's interesting. We hope we are building up your knowledge from the best in the business world on taking care of business exclusively on RPPFM. We'll be right back after this. I better think it's about 10 to 12. And how important, Luke, is thinking when it comes to social intelligence, or should we be feeling more?
Well, the important thing is actually to have a full, complete, satisfying life. It's actually about paying attention to both. Not one more than the other. But the important thing is to be aware of that your thinking drives a lot of your behaviours and emotions. And sometimes your thinking can get in the way of you actually having that enjoyable life. So sometimes you need to change your thinking.
Okay. And self-awareness. Critical. Yeah. Critical.
Self-awareness is critical. Self-insight is critical. But interestingly, as what Heidi was saying before, getting feedback from others is so important because, as we talked earlier, we're usually pretty bad judges of our own behaviour and things like that. So to do a brave thing like Heidi does, which is ask other people for feedback, is something that we can all do.
We can all improve on, always.
Yep.
Heidi Catherine. Mm-hmm. You have, on Soul Weaver that you won the award for.
Yes.
Was a young adult romance. So sort of in the genre of Hunger Games, Twilight, is that right?
Yes,
absolutely. Okay.
Yes.
What are you working on now?
I'm actually writing my first crime novel. So
that's a leap.
It is a bit of a leap, but I found myself being drawn to books like Gone Girl and Girl on the Train, and I've been loving those books. And I'm a really firm believer that you need to write the kind of book that you like to read. And I had this idea burning away in the back of my mind, and I needed a little bit of a rest from young adult, although I do intend to go back to that as soon as I can. And the only way to get this idea out of my mind was to write it out. So I'm 50,000 words in and on track to have it finished by the end of the year.
So with things like crime, you've got to get it right. You can't make up you know, how the crime scene's laid out. You want it to be authentic. How do you do that?
Well, I'm figuring that out as I go a little bit. Mm-hmm. And my father was actually a forensic scientist for 30 years.
That helps.
So he's consulting for me on the book, and excellent. That's been an excellent help. Yeah. So I'm just having fun with it at this stage. So I've still got a lot more work to do on it, but I'm enjoying it, and that's telling me that if I'm enjoying it, then I'm clearly doing the right thing.
Yeah, because the research side, that's the bit that I'd like. I just like to do the research and not do the writing. But how much research do you do before you start writing?
Oh, thank goodness for the internet. I don't know how people did it before. Yeah. I Google a lot. Google is my friend. Mm. So I have to do a lot of research, but I tend to do it as I go along. So when I hit a point in the plot where I know I'm kind of just making it up, I'll get on the internet, find out some facts, and then keep ploughing through. Or sometimes I'll just make myself a note, check this out later, and keep moving forward if I'm on a bit of a roll.
So when are you expecting that to be finished?
Hopefully by the end of the year, I would say.
And then what happens? You try to go and get it published?
That's the plan, yes.
And have you made some good contacts after winning this award? Like, how has it changed things?
Yeah, it's what's been fantastic. The awards were part of an annual conference run by Romance Writers of Australia, and that was attended by almost 400 writers and also editors. Agents, everybody from the industry was there. So I have made some fantastic contacts from that conference. It's been terrific.
Oh, they'd be loving her, wouldn't they, Luke?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Let's hope.
Because you sort of assume writers are introverted and not very good communicators. And I mean, Heidi Catherine's just a delight.
Yep.
She's sitting here. I've got to say that. But you know, obvious, isn't it? I'm sure that anyone listening can see how engaging and charming she is. So
absolutely.
She's a marketer's dream.
Thank you, Jack.
So thank you, Heidi Catherine. Wish you all the very best.
Thank you very much.
Really
it's been
good,
really
to have
fun
you.
Being on your show.
Yeah, it's been great. You. Great to have you here, Luke Ross, as always. A psychological delight.
that could be taken in a number of ways.
The mind wanderer. Now, we're just going to finish off quickly with a pearl of wisdom.
Yep.
Welcome to Taking Care of Businesses, Pearls of Wisdom with Jackie Mitchell.
Luke Ross, I love you. Well, your whole presence here is a pearl of wisdom. I love listening to what you've got to say. But have you got a special one you'd like to leave us with for the weekend?
Yeah, this one's about life satisfaction. So life satisfaction comes from focusing on what you have as opposed to what you want.
Oh, that's good. Heidi Catherine, have you got a pearl of wisdom?
I'm going to touch on what I just spoke about a little earlier. If you want to write a book, don't start at your computer. Start at your bookcase and write the kind of book you'd like to read.
Oh, that's deep.
That's cool.
That's deep. I like that. Well, I want to pick up on Luke's automatic thought. So when we go into automatic thought, to be aware of that, and then if it's a negative automatic thought, to actually change it with a positive one. I think that's a really, useful, handy tip. But I'd like to thank Luke Ross, Heidi Catherine. Thank you for being on today's show. We hope you've heard lots of advice and inspiration today. Don't forget you can see Taking Care of Business on Sky Business News on the Small Business Channel on Foxtel. A new show next Tuesday at 2:30. So series link it, join the discussion, as well as on Twitter and Facebook. We try to be everywhere. And we've got some breaking news. Those that have liked Taking Care of Business on Facebook, right on midday, you'll see we're just announcing that Taking Care of Business is now going, for the first time ever, live on stage. So we've got a real audience. We're expecting 200 plus people. It's at Mornington Racecourse, Thursday the 12th of November. It's a breakfast and with the panel, and you can pre-send questions through if you're running a business. The panel, we have marketing experts, social media experts, finance experts, a whole range of sales experts. And then during the breakfast, you can SMS your questions up onto the stage, and our panel will take care of that with your business as well. So really excited. Bookings are available through the Frankston Mornington Peninsula Council. There's a link to their website on our Facebook page. So really exciting. We're really looking forward to that. But the most important thing to remember is that customers and staff are only human, and a good balance of heart and mind is the key. Here is Billy Joel. We look forward to your company next Friday at 11 a.m. In the meantime, keep taking care of your business.